Okay, welcome back, everybody. Courtesy of Prem, here we have a nice little palm leaf manuscript here. So this is an example. We had the picture with Martin Skoyan a bit earlier. And so here's the manuscript of the Dhammapada. This one's much smaller than typical, but you can see often, you know, about this size that they'd be. But you can see the kind of material, this one made of the palm. In the northern ones, like those ones held there, probably birch bark, slightly different material, but the same kind of thing. So anyway, this is up here. If you want to come up and have a look at it sometime, you're most welcome. Okay. Okay, so in this part, we wanted to make this much more discussion-based and interactive. So please feel free to ask questions and so on. And we wanted to talk, first of all, about what is challenged by early Buddhism. And the next one, we're going to be talking, what are the challenges that early Buddhism faces? And one of the essential qualities of any spiritual path is it has to challenge, right? If a spiritual path just says, oh yeah, whatever, and lets you go on living your life without actually challenging your values and your way of life and your views and your all of those things, then what good's it doing? I don't think it's doing much good at all. I think it's a bit of a waste of time. But unfortunately, it seems that that's what sometimes a lot of people want from their spiritual path. They basically want a cupcake as their spiritual savior, I guess. They want something comforting and reassuring. And of course, it's always nice to have something comforting and reassuring. But I think that we live in a world where there are enough challenges and enough difficulties that we want something that's a bit more rigorous and a bit more asks a bit more of us. I don't think we should be ashamed of that or afraid of it. Okay, so there are certain things, or many things, which are challenged by early Buddhism. And all I've done is just make a bit of a list here and thrown it up. And so this is just a few examples of things that I thought, and I'm sure you can all think of many other ones. And I'll just give you a few ideas of the kinds of things that I was thinking about, okay? So various forms of sectarian Buddhism. Any form of sectarian Buddhism is challenged by early Buddhism because the Buddha didn't teach any of the sects. All of the sects of Buddhism came later. And any claim that any of the sects of Buddhism have to be a sort of unique truth or you know, the Theravadins say that, well, we've got the earliest one. The Tibetans say we've got the fullest one. And everyone says we've got the best one and so on. And basically it's all rubbish. Every sect has good things and bad things. Every sect has early things and late things. And every sect has something to offer and some things that you probably want to leave aside. Truth does not reside within a sect. Truth resides within the Dhamma. So any form of sectarian Buddhism is deeply challenged by a serious study and investigation into early Buddhism. This is one of the major obstacles to a study of early Buddhism in any traditional country. And that applies to Mahayana. Obviously, the Mahayana sutras are late, and that's a fact which has been faced and addressed by some Mahayana scholars and practitioners in some of the East Asian countries, especially Taiwan, Japan, and Vietnam, and Korea also, but much less so in the Tibetan sphere, where you don't really find any I've never really found any acknowledgement or appreciation of the implications of our historical understanding of early Buddhism within the Tibetan schools. Of course, the facts are there. How you respond to the facts is a different matter, and that's up to the individual. So, for example, one of the best known response to that was from Master Yin Shun, who was probably the most influential of all the Taiwanese or Chinese scholar monks in the 20th century. And he did a very deep study of early Buddhist texts, including the Pali texts and other early Buddhist texts in Chinese. And on his findings, I've drawn a lot of my own research from his findings. Yin Shun more and more moved during his life towards emphasizing the importance of the early Buddhist texts, but he always strove to draw parallels and linkages between what was found in the early texts and what was found in the Mahayana Sutras, especially the early Mahayana Sutras. So he didn't see that as, in a sense, diminishing the worth of those texts, but he saw it as the framework within which the worth of those texts could be properly understood. Similarly with Theravada, is also very challenged by early Buddhism because Theravada makes a very strong claim to represent the original unadulterated form of Buddhism, and you can find these kinds of claims in any number of books by Theravadan scholars, and it's simply untrue. If you go to Theravadan countries, you'll find that they are absolutely rampantly full of all kinds of superstitions, magic practices, tattoos, amulets, and all kinds of rubbish, which all parades under the heading of Buddhism, not to mention the somewhat more respectable things like the Abhidhamma and so on and so forth, which also makes the historically inaccurate claim to be the word of the Buddha. So these are challenges for the traditions, and mostly the traditions respond to the challenge by belittling their opponents and trying to pretend that hopefully that reason and facts will go away. Unfortunately, they usually don't. Another thing that's strongly challenged by early Buddhism is the forest tradition. Of course, part of this was the bhikkhuni ordination that we did a few years ago. If you believe that, as is believed very strongly in the Thai forest tradition, that what they are practicing is exactly what was done in the time of the Buddha. Everything that's done is exactly the colour of the robes, the way food is offered. Everything is done exactly as it was in the Buddha's day. This is how the monks there think. Then the idea of bhikkhunis becomes anathema and is unthinkable. The idea of things like, say, questioning one's teacher becomes anathema. You can't do that because, according to the forest tradition, the teachers are all enlightened and you can't question them. So these whole ideas of that one can study and learn and understand for oneself, and the process of inquiry and challenging and evidence is not found at all within that tradition. And so in saying that these different sects of Buddhism are challenged by this, it's not, of course, to devalue the traditions or to say that there's nothing of value in them. Of course there is. But the point is that by using our understanding that we can gain through return to what the Buddha taught, it gives us a framework and a guide by which we can hopefully invigorate and free these traditions from the shackles of all of these kinds of things, which are really not what the Buddha was talking about. And so the aim is to try to bring life back to these traditions. And this is something that happens constantly in religions. We always see this dynamic of this constant sense of revolution and so on going on. Any questions, comments before I go on? No? You're quite happy with the idea of religion as a revolution? Yeah, but it's the right sect. Yes. Sorry, just one second. Chulika? Yeah, sure. Well, of course, yeah. Early Buddhism is late Buddhism, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, look, there's nothing worse than an early Buddhist fundamentalist, let me tell you. I know, it's terrible. No, it's very true, and this is why I explicitly made that point just now, that it's not about saying that all the traditions are wrong and so on and so forth, but it's about trying to having a view, a point of view by which that we gives us an opportunity to understand what is of value, be able to tease out those things that are of value. There are various brands of early Buddhist fundamentalism out there, and most of them are a little bit nutty, I'd have to say, it's my opinion. not all of them, but there does tend to be it's just sort of kind of human nature. You kind of latch onto something which is good in itself, but then it becomes a bit of an extreme. And so these are some of the things. This is actually part of the next slide, is to talk about these things which are the challenges to early Buddhism, things early Buddhism is challenged by. And I think this is one of the most important ones. Yeah, thank you for that, and that's certainly something we've tried to be conscious of, and we do have to be very much conscious of, is that we can only do certain kinds of things, right? We can't read the Buddha's mind or whatever. We can do certain kinds of things, and there are certain kinds of problems which we can actually solve with a reasonable degree of confidence, and that, of course, leaves a whole bunch of other issues which we can't, and so we just have to accept that. What do you reckon? Okay, he's fine, he's good. Okay, go on, Dania. Well, that's what I usually say. Cheers, thank you. Well, I think that would be nice, but you know, to me, the main thing about the goal is not to aim at any particular end state, but more about just more. It's about a process of questioning, and that to me, that's the essential thing. Yeah. I know at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery in the south of Thailand for a while, they wanted to call themselves Dhammists rather than Buddhists. Yeah. Yeah. So the question is there a lot of feedback from these ideas back into the communities? So this is something that we've tried to emphasise from the beginning, is that the ideas of early Buddhism has actually been in a dialogue with traditional Buddhist cultures right from the beginning. Yeah? So that's why we mentioned right from the start that there is this kind of European investigation into Buddhism on historic grounds, but that went side by side with reforms of Buddhism that were practiced in different ways in different traditional Buddhist countries. And those Buddhist reforms, all of them, you can see, in some ways have drawn upon the ideas of what we're talking about as early Buddhism here, often in ways that we don't actually realize it. I mean, like the very notion of Buddhism being an obvious example, and these things are modern constructs. And so we often don't realize how much these things are embodied. In terms of how they're being brought into practical application, yes, they are, but that in different ways, in different places, and it really depends on so many other social and cultural conditions that are going on at that time. And in particular, I would say this, for me, I think the single most defining characteristic is the quality of education. And in most Buddhist countries, the quality of education is fairly poor. And certainly that was the case when I was in Thailand. There was a very low level of education in Buddhism. In countries where there's been a strong emphasis on education, the main ones being Japan and Taiwan, after the war and when the Buddhist monastics left from China and settled in Taiwan around the 1950s and 1960s, they made a very, very strong emphasis. All the leaders of the Sangha at that time made a very strong emphasis on education for the Sangha. And so, you know, that's why you see a lot of these universities and things like that have come up, and they really have very good standards. So in that kind of environment where you do find people are much better educated, then, you know, often you find much more application of these kinds of ideas, much more openness to them. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So the question about whether the globalism means that there's a lot more dialogue between the different sects, I think yes, there is. But again, it's still, I think, somewhat limited. I think that a lot of that doesn't penetrate very far into traditional Buddhist cultures. I do feel, and this is probably true, especially the Theravadan world, I'm not quite sure of whether this applies more generally, but I certainly think in the South Indian sphere, South India, South Asia, I think there's been basically a cultural backslide since the mid-20th century. I think we saw in the middle of the 20th century a lot of very, very prominent and strong Sri Lankan scholars, Indian scholars, even Thai, Burmese and so on, who came up and made a big impact on the international and global sphere. I'm thinking of people like, any number of them, Kesari Dhammananda, Bhante Gunaratna, Narada Thera, Rahula Sankrityayana from India, Mahasi Sayadaw, Ajahn Mahan, Buddhadasa, and so on and so forth. And we had that very, you know, a lot of really strong leaders, and now there's no one. Honestly, try to think of a single Sangha leader from any of those countries who actually has any impact at all outside of their own local tradition. I'm struggling to think of one. Sorry? Dalai Lama's not from that area. Yeah. But yeah, he's one example. Any Thai monks, Burmese monks, Sri Lankan monks who have any influence at all outside of their own cultural sphere. I would really like it if there were, but I can't think of any. I don't know why that is. I've asked quite a lot of people about this. I think there are sometimes specific historical circumstances that lead to it, but anyway, that's just how it is. What can I say? Uh-huh. Well, there's always a need. People are always suffering. Well, we could be here for several weeks discussing specific issues. Yeah. Well, we do what we can. And I'm not trying to belittle anybody's contribution. There are lots of people making lots of kinds of contributions, obviously. But there just seems to have been, to me, a falling off of the ability of Buddhists from traditional backgrounds to speak to a global audience. This is something that I haven't really seen in the last few decades. I don't know, maybe. I think one of the things that happens if you start to focus on what the early Buddhist teachings are is, of course, most of them are those kinds of universal truths, aren't they? They're the Four Noble Truths and... Possibly, yeah. The only reason I'm hesitating is that to me sometimes that kind of idea can be a bit, well, anybody can say anything's a universal truth. It's difficult to really get a grasp of what it is. But look, I think it's a fair enough comment, yeah. Okay, more questions? Yes. Okay, so a quick question about the Dalit communities in India who have converted to Buddhism. So for those of you who don't know the history there, from around in the 40s and 50s, there was a strong movement led by Ambedkar, who was the writer of the Indian Constitution. And he, having been a Hindu, converted to Buddhism and led many millions, I think about 2 or 3 million of Dalits or something, to convert to Buddhism in the 1950s. Unfortunately, Ambedkar, after having done this public conversion and so on, then died, which is very inconvenient of him, and the movement kind of stagnated since then. But it still has quite a lot of strength, and there's been a lot of studies that show that the Dalits who have converted to Buddhism prosper according to any number of metrics like poverty, health, education, treatment of women, and so on. So it definitely does have positive effects. It's quite challenging and controversial within the Indian sphere. Basically, untouchables are the slaves. They clean the toilets, take out the rubbish, and do all the crap that nobody wants to do. So if you empower them, hey, I'm an individual. I can go to university, get a job and a degree, and then I can employ you to come and clean my toilets, then that has a certain a political dimension as well. So the whole thing with the Dalits is quite fraught in India, actually. You have to be quite careful around it. When I was in Bodh Gaya about 4 or 5 years ago, some Dalit Buddhists had destroyed a Kali shrine, which was in one of the Buddhist sites. Okay, so there was one of the caves the Buddhists practice in. Some Hindus had put a Kali shrine or something there, and these monks apparently thought, this is rubbish, this is a Buddhist place, and they trashed the Kali shrine, which was perhaps not the best idea. And a couple of nights later, a couple of Buddhist monks get mugged and beaten up in the Bodh Gaya precincts. So, yeah, it's, when I say it's fraught, I mean it's fraught, yeah. But still, you know, they have quite a strong tradition, but it tends to be still fairly self-contained. Except there, as always, if you find them more educated, and when the Dalits become more educated, then they read, this is one thing you find with global Buddhism, if you go to South America or Poland or India, what are they reading? Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm, Thich Nhat Hanh, Jack Kornfield. You know, it's the same kind of global Buddhism that you find anywhere. Yeah. Okay. So a few other things. Challenged vipassana, we've talked a bit about this earlier. I don't think we need to go over that again. Abhidhamma, we've also talked about. Secular Buddhism, I don't think we've touched on yet, but secular Buddhism, many of you probably know, is a sort of fairly recent movement, which in a way takes some of the rationalizing tendencies that we've been talking about in early Buddhism and takes it to a logical extreme of wanting to get rid of things like rebirth and karma is the most famous aspect, monastics and anything like that which smacks of quote-unquote religion, psychic powers or anything like that, and even enlightenment. Now, this is something I was quite surprised to. I've had a couple of dialogues with secular Buddhists in Sydney, and they're quite firm on that, actually. The whole idea that you can actually be enlightened is pretty much out of the window. It's all about you can get more wisdom, but you can't actually be enlightened. Anyway, so and often what you find with the secular Buddhists is that they will base themselves on arguments found in the early suttas, people like Stephen Batchelor and so on. And so I think, you know, give them their due for actually paying attention to what the suttas are saying and actually taking them seriously. But my own feeling is that they suffer from trying to read their own arguments into the early suttas and end up making very tenuous arguments. And I personally would find their position and their approach much more interesting and authentic if they were to simply admit, we don't believe in rebirth, the Buddha taught rebirth, and so I believe that the Buddha was wrong on the subject of rebirth, and you know this is how we deal with that. To me, that would be a much more honest and straightforward way of dealing with the situation. But anyway, so I think secular Buddhism also is challenged by early Buddhist texts for that reason. Psychology is another one. Psychology. I mainly put this one up there because my good friend Dr. Eng Kong Tan is a psychiatrist. He was in Sydney when we did this course last week, so I wanted to put this up here. So any Buddhist psychologists in the room? You don't have to be ashamed. It's all right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, Buddhism has certainly enriched psychology immeasurably. And this is, again, this is not just a new thing. This is happening at least since the time of William James, one of the founders of psychology, if not actually quite a bit before that. You even look at the pre-psychologists and people like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, who were very influential in the formation of that kind of worldview. But anyway, well, exactly. How is psychology challenged by early Buddhism? Well, for one thing, a lot of psychology, not all psychology, but a lot of psychology tends to have quite a materialist viewpoint, so seeing things as being caused by the brain. We also find these kinds of ideas of... I think one kind of theoretical thing is you have this idea of kind of childhood trauma and so on. From a Buddhist point of view, you have like karmic trauma, right? So you've got the trauma you've had from how many countless bad childhoods that you've had for countless of millions of years. You're going to sit there on a psychiatrist's couch and work through all of them. Oh, 72 lifetimes ago, my mummy told me to shut up, and I really wasn't thinking. So obviously, this is, you know, we come into this life already with a lot of psychic and psychological baggage, and that raises a lot of interest, I think, interesting questions in terms of how we're going to approach dealing with things. But I think on a deeper level, what the challenge that Buddhism poses is that we can go beyond mental health. We can go beyond just coping. We can go beyond just not being neurotic, right? And I think this is something that I think that some forms of psychology have started to acknowledge and to integrate, but I think it's only just beginning. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I agree, and I think that Jung was probably the first one to introduce into Western psychology the idea that the process of becoming more conscious and becoming more aware is fundamental, and that's something which continues for your whole life. Yeah, so I think these were some very valuable contributions that he made. Yeah. Sure, that's one challenge, absolutely, yeah. 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 Yes. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They spend all day doing that, my personal belief is that what the psychologists have done is to reframe a lot of Buddhist ideas into more digestible forms, which have taken these things into places that we can't, and address problems in ways that we can't also. So I don't think it's not one or the other or better or worse, but it's just understanding that there are different purposes for these things. Yeah. Yes. No, but also Buddhism's borrowed a lot from psychology without acknowledging it either. Yeah? So, in what sense? Oh, how far back do you want to go? Oh, well, in those days, yeah, that stuff wasn't borrowed from psychology. That stuff was borrowed from the Hindus, yeah. But, maybe so. Look, I think everyone borrows from everyone, and I think that's fine. I should leave it there. I could go on for some time. Eddie, sorry. Go on. Oh, yeah. If that was in California. I was in Montreal. Okay. That's true, yeah. Do you want to comment on it? Do you want to say something about the irreducible mind?
Let's wait until we get back down to scientific materialism. What do you want to do now?
Oh, you're doing that. It's not strictly linearist anyway.
Yeah.
Fun?
Yeah, this also comes up on the next slide, actually. It's also here, this idea of scientific materialism. And, of course, the idea behind that is that the scientific materialism means that everything is reducible to material phenomena, and including the mind, including consciousness. And, of course, that's very different from the Buddhist idea. And the problem with that is that this is essentially the scientific worldview, as we explain now. It has been for a long time, and it still is, and it probably will be for still quite a while. But and of course, from a Buddhist point of view, a Buddhist, as I see myself, is someone who's searching for truth, right? You cannot just chuck out the science and say, well, I'm a Buddhist, I'm not going to believe in science. It doesn't work. If science is a search for truth, so if it's Buddhism, you somehow have to integrate science and Buddhism together, and only then does it actually start to make sense. So you have to take this thing seriously. That's I think, the first issue. Anyone who sort of is willing to chuck out evolution or chuck out any of the findings of modern findings of physics, I find it very hard to take that seriously. So the question then is, what is the scientific basis for this kind of claim, the idea of scientific materialism? And it seems to me that essentially, when you start to, I don't know all that much about it, but the little thing I know about it is that the scientific foundation for saying these things is very weak, and they don't actually know what they're talking about. The understanding of the human mind is still at the very beginning of the scientific research. People don't really know what's happening, how the mind works, all these things. And because of that, you don't actually have to take the idea of scientific materialism as a fact which has been demonstrated absolutely. So that is actually very freeing, because it means that, well, okay, let's see what science comes up with in the future. Right, as far as I'm concerned right now, it's not something that you have to believe in as an absolute certainty here. You can put it to one side and see how is science going to evolve. And interesting, this was just the book that Mantasiddhartha was just referring to now, called Irreducible Mind. And by irreducible here means that the mind is not reducible to material phenomena. In other words, the mind cannot be explained completely by material phenomena in its own right. And what this book does is presents a lot of evidence, and a lot of it is obviously very hard evidence, scientific evidence, for why the mind is not reducible in this way here. And some of the evidence there is very powerful. I remember one of the things that I thought was very powerful was this idea that they were looking at Alzheimer's disease, and they were looking at people, what happened to people just as they're about to pass away from Alzheimer's. And apparently it's quite common that people just before they're about to pass away, certainly they get clearer. Completely clear. They recognize all the people around them. They can have a conversation again. They've been a complete vegetable, perhaps, for a long time. And suddenly, things start working again. And that cannot really be explained from a scientific materialistic point of view, because the mind is still going to be subject to that brain, which is damaged, basically. But from a Buddhist point of view, you can possibly explain that. You can explain it as the mind starting to kind of disassociate from material phenomena, so the brain is no longer ruling the mind to the same extent it was before, so it can't be understood. And there's lots more evidence in that book which points in that direction. So the paradigm, if you like, the scientific paradigm, the scientific worldview that we're living under now is very likely to change, because it is a very, I think, a very weak scientific paradigm.
Okay. So anything more about monkeys and neuroscience and so on? All right. Traditional and ritual...
I just want to say something about psychology as well. Because just to pick up what Chris Perry was talking about before... or more generally about psychology. And one of the things, of course, in modern psychology, one of the most important things that modern psychology has taken from Buddhism is the idea of mindfulness, right? This is what you see particularly in the United States. It's everywhere. Now it's actually everywhere around the world. And even when I was in Norway, I read an article that was highly critical of the kind of mindfulness technique that is going around. And I think one of the problems there, this is a classical example of me of cherry-picking from the Buddhist teachings. You take one factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, one little thing, you pick it out and make that the be-all and the end-all of your technique. And you sent me recently, Chris, some articles on psychology that actually try to expand that view and also bring in ethics and morality as well into the idea, you know, the mental states that you're dealing, not just mindfulness itself, but actually overcoming negative states, etc. And that, of course, is the Buddhist point of view. If you want to, the Buddhist idea is that mindfulness is not something that exists on its own by itself, that you can just develop just like that without any kind of context. You need the right context. And it's only when the context is right that actually mindfulness becomes possible. And that context in Buddhism is ethics, right? It is the actions of body and speech, positive and negative, and also the action of the mind. All of these things are part of that context. And without that context, you can try as you might, as much as you want. And mindfulness, okay, you can maybe do a little bit to develop mindfulness, but it's going to come to a standstill very, very quickly because you haven't got the supporting factors. That, I think, is one of the great weaknesses and where Buddhism at least should challenge psychology, to actually give them the whole picture rather than, you know, picking out one little thing. It's going to be extremely limited if you try practicing psychology in that way, I think.
Hong Kong's kind of best of breed, though. Yeah. Yes. No, it definitely is possible. See, one of the problems with psychology is that from the roots of psychology, it had to kind of divorce itself from religion and establish itself as a science. So they're always a bit kind of scared about getting dragged back into religion again. So there's that kind of fear, but... Yeah. Eddie. Yeah, it's very holistic. No, I agree. Yeah. Yep. Okay, other things challenged by early Buddhism. Oh, sorry, Ainsley. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay, traditional and ritual Buddhism, another thing challenged by early Buddhism, and this, of course, is the main thing that's practiced most traditional Buddhist countries, you know, lots of chanting and holy water and these kinds of things. And it's always a tussle, I know from being in the forest monasteries in Thailand, that there's always a tussle going on between the forest monks and the lay people in the village are always wanting you to go and do more ceremonies and coming doing this and doing that, getting blessings and all of these kinds of things. And so you're always trying to be more secluded, go away and do some more meditation and so on and so forth. But the problem is that the more you do that, the holier you become and the more powerful that your magic spells are. So if you... if you finally succeed in going away and doing some meditation, then it gets a complete nightmare. So there's always kind of back and forth on doing this, and it's most of the people who have that background in traditional Buddhism will know automatically what I'm talking about. But for those people who don't have that background, I think it's really important to maybe just to learn a bit about that, spend some time, travel around to some different countries and just see what is it that traditional Buddhists do and what is their Buddhist life. And it's very different from what you might think. And I'll just give you one anecdote of this that a friend of mine shared with me a couple of weeks ago when I commented about this. And she said that when the Waisak had come, the last Waisak in Singapore, she'd told her sister, oh, let's go to the Buddhist temple and bring something and we'll get it blessed. Okay, so this is what you do. Waisak, that's the only Buddhist thing that she does for the year, right? So it's like in Christianity, the only thing you do is like you go on Christmas or something like that. So this is your Buddhist activity for the year. Go on a Waisak and get something blessed by the monk, right? And so she got a Buddha image from her home, took it along to the temple. There's a big long line of people getting stuff blessed by the monk. She got to the front of the queue, and the monk's about to bless her Buddha, and then he was so happy and was like, oh wow, that's amazing, and he was smiling, and she was saying, why are you smiling? And he said, oh, it's a Buddha. And she turned around and looked, and everybody else was getting like wallets and keys and all of these kinds of things blessed. And she was the only person who actually had a Buddha there to be blessed, right? So. Only when he was having a bath. No. This is all commentarial legends. Yeah, that's what you do when you have these kind of practices that are not found in the suttas. You have to invent some kind of legend that'll justify it for you. Yeah. So yeah. Yes. So yeah. Absolutely. Yes. It always seems. That's a very, very good point, and often it's very similar kinds of challenges. I mean, this is what the Buddha was challenging in his time, was all the rituals and all of these kinds of things, and all of those things that we're talking about. I mean, okay, we're talking about it in a particular modern idiom when we talk about psychology and so on and so forth, but the same idea we definitely found in the Buddha's time. For example, people might take up like one practice or another practice and say, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And the Buddha was saying, well, look, you know, you've got eight factors in the Eightfold Path. You have to have a more holistic approach and so on. So the actual kinds of challenges which we're facing today are very similar to the kinds of challenges which the Buddha faced. And to me, that's one of the valuable things about when we read the suttas is we're actually seeing that dialogue as it unfolds. We're not just receiving the results of it and being told, you know, early Buddhism is X, Y, Z. We're actually seeing that process. Early Buddhism is, to me, a process of questioning and inquiry and reflection and all of those kinds of things. Yep. Yep. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Eddie. Oh, the hats. Yeah, but the hats are cool. Uh-huh. Yeah, sure. Sure, yeah. Sorry, we had a previous question over here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Hmm. Well, no, I think it's a bit more empirical, and sort of based on a historical approach rather than yeah. Yeah, sure. I will be politically correct and avoid commenting on that. But yeah. Sorry. Yes. Oh, of course, it happens all the time. We could have many stories about that. But your point is taken, and the point is a good one. And this is also what we find in the suttas when the Buddha tried to like repurpose Brahmanical rituals. I mean, the best known example is the Sigalovada Sutta, when you know he found the Brahmin who was sort of worshipping in the different directions and so on. Buddha says, well, you know, if you want to worship in the different directions, you can, but this is the better way to do it. And then he goes on, gives him this very nice teaching about the right way, or not the right way, but about the more meaningful way of doing those things. So as far as rituals and so on go, the important point is that the Buddha was clearly and definitively against any form of religion or ritual practice that would be harmful. Okay, so this is where the line is drawn, animal sacrifice in particular. And so that's basically a line drawn. You can't do that from a Buddhist point of view. But other forms of ritual, if they're intrinsically they're not harmful in themselves, then of course they can be done with a good spirit or with a bad spirit and so on and so forth. So partly that's that matter of what your intention is, but also it's a matter sometimes of the emphasis. Again, I have a little bit of experience, like living within the Sangha. One of the things that you realize about doing rituals is that they're incredibly easy. That's why people do them, right? Giving Dhamma talks is hard, right? You have to actually know stuff, right? And you have to actually be able to communicate. Sitting there and doing a bit of chanting and drinking a bit of holy water, it's the easiest in the world, it's falling off a log, right? And so you can see why these things become, there's no challenge for the people receiving on either side of that ritual. It's just very simple, it's very easy. And that's not a bad thing, right? You don't have to be, we want to be challenged by our religion, but you don't want to be challenged every day. I mean, come on, right? Sometimes you just want to come out and give a bit of offering, a bit of chanting, and then you feel good and go on with your life. And that's okay too. So sometimes the rituals have their role to play. So again, it's not a matter of saying it's right or wrong, but it's more a matter of saying, well, what's really at the heart of our religious practice? And remembering that for a lot of people, that's all there is, right? They don't have anything else. They've never heard any Dhamma teachings. Yeah? Well, again, it depends on how you go about it, really. Yeah. What kind of ritual do you mean? Yeah. I think that there is, so just to repeat the question, but I think that there is, the question was about whether there's a distinction between somebody who wants to give alms or donations just for the sake of it and somebody who wants to do it because they're going to get something back. All right, that's the point. No? Yeah. Right. Yeah, oh, that's what I was meaning by getting something back. Oh, okay, fair enough, okay. What can I say? Do you have anything to say? Well, you just do your best. I don't know. Look, I personally think we should try to minimize those kinds of things as much as possible and try to raise people up. I don't know. Sorry, not very articulate response. Down the back. Yes, I would agree, and I think that on the whole that should be part of it. What you find when you read the suttas is the Buddha's always saying, you know, don't be satisfied, keep asking questions, keep finding out, keep honing your understanding. So I would hope that the path of pursuing a deeper understanding of early Buddhism, in a sense, is self-correcting in that way. Yeah. And that's why, again, it's an ongoing process. It's not a static thing. And we've looked at all of these examples of people practicing early Buddhism throughout history, and they all thought they were doing early Buddhism, and they all were, but it all meant something different to each one. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, just respond a little bit to what Ayaprasanna was saying before, about rituals and about holy water sprinkling, these kind of issues. And I think, obviously, the most important thing is your intention, right? If your intention is, when I sprinkle this person with all of what, I'll get a big donation back, yeah, that is obviously a bit dodgy. But if you do it because it is part of a tradition, the way things are done, and I think you can actually do that in different ways. You can even do it in skillful ways. And what I sometimes do, I say, when somebody wants to get a water sprinkling, I tell them that, well, you know, this is not really the real blessing. The real blessing is when you keep the precepts. That's what's going to have a blessing in the long run. And after I said that to them maybe two or three times, they don't come back again after that. It's true. It works. Because they understand that what I'm saying, actually, this is not really the real issue. Sometimes you just have to be a bit wise about how we go about these things. And then people's perceptions start to change.
Bodhnyana, one of our regular sprinklees, is the guys from the kickboxing club. Yeah, they come down there quite often too. You know, they've got a new match coming up on the weekend or something like that. I don't know. Yeah. Well, what my own experience, Dania, the you know, I always thought that our tradition was somewhat stripped back in terms of rituals, but then I went to Townsville and I attended a meeting by a Thai monk there. Is it from the Thai? He'd been in forest monasteries and so on, and this Thai monk came along and he did this evening meeting every Sunday, quite popular actually in Townsville. They'd get maybe 20, 30 people along. And the meeting consisted of everybody coming along, and at 5 o'clock he would say, start walk meditation. And they would walk meditation for half an hour, and then he'd say, stop walk meditation, start sit meditation. And they'd sit meditation for half an hour, and then he'd say, stop sit meditation. And they'd stop sitting meditation. And that was it. That was literally and absolutely the only thing that happened. There was no bowing, there was no chanting, there was no nothing. That's all that happened. Oh, that was pretty cool. People seemed to like it. They came. They did walking meditation. They did sitting meditation. Yeah, they went home. That's good. Yes. Yes, and you can't make people do things. So sometimes, you know, you try to lead people along, and you have. This is why you can't make hard and fast judgments on these things. Sometimes, you know, you just try to see where a person's at and just try to lift them up a little bit, try to help them. That's all. Yeah. Yes. Right. Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a good point, yeah. Eddie. I have some other questions over here, Eddie. Thanks. Yeah. Okay, yes. Yep. Yeah. So what should you do? Yeah, well, there are lots of different forms of traditions. This is another thing with tradition, just incidentally, is that tradition is usually very shallow, actually. Tradition is usually what people did 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and everyone thinks it was what was done 2,000 years ago. But anyway, in a particular case, what can you say? I mean, there's lots of people around the place who say lots of things. Some of them may be true, some of them are not. But, you know, be cautious if you hear people saying those things, if they're monks or whatever. Maybe they've got a great reputation, maybe they don't, maybe they can do all kinds of amazing things. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to where's your mind at? If you get sick, who cares whether it was caused by something that happened to you thousands of lifetimes ago, or whether it was something that you ate or because you smoked, you know? The Dharma point of view is, can you accept that your illness? Are you going to be full of anxiety and stress because of it? And so on and so forth. So that's really the Dharma. So as far as these kinds of things, and we always have to be a little bit... I would just urge people to be very cautious before taking these things too seriously. What you'll find is if there are good monks who have those kinds of abilities, that they usually don't go around trumpeting them all over the place. And if they do talk about them, it'll be occasionally and very discreetly, and they probably won't actually want to talk about it very much. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that journalist certainly should have come to our early Buddhism course, yeah. Which one, what, sorry? Atheism. Well, no, it's a bit different because atheism is, I would say Buddhism is atheist, but atheism isn't materialist necessarily. Right. Exactly, yeah. And this is the problem. And a lot of what that comes back to is what I mentioned before, and I think one of the single most important thing, I think, to improve and empower Buddhism in traditional countries is education. And I honestly believe if you really want to empower it on a large scale, you have to start with a good education in actual Dhamma. And this is, I think, one of the main reasons why these things happen, is because a lot of the times the Sangha is very poorly educated, and all they know is how to say the same Dhamma sayings that they've known, you know, their whole lives, which, you know, are perfectly good Dhamma sayings, but they don't know how to sort of cope and respond in this very, very fast changing world. Yeah. So I really think that having a good education is extremely important on the whole in Buddhist countries. Sri Lanka might be, I think, a little bit better. I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on there, but I certainly know from my experience in Thailand that basically you'd get almost no Dhamma education in the Thai schools, and not from the temples and things either. Yeah. But your comment brings us on to the next point there, which is the theism. Of course, early Buddhism challenges theism. I think all forms of Buddhism really do. But so the idea that you have to have a god to explain things is of course challenged by scientific materialism. But you have this crisis, really, or perceived crisis in the West, which has been clearly articulated at the very least from the time of Nietzsche. Which is basically that if God doesn't exist, then anything is permissible, right? So if your spirituality is entirely based on the idea of right and wrong and good and everything like that is based on the idea of God, take God out of the picture, everything collapses. This is the fear which we found throughout a lot of Western thinkers from that time, the time of Nietzsche, at the very least. Whereas from the Buddhist point of view, what we actually have is an example of a spirituality which is not only powerful and profound and rational and so on and so forth, but which has been proven for 2,500 years to be the basis of many of the world's greatest civilizations ever, okay? But without this idea of the creator God who's going to be telling do this and do that and then the other. It can be done. You can have a profound spiritual path which provides a sense of meaning and aspiration and all the good things which religion gives, but without having to have God. And that is not just something which is suitable for a few kind of elite meditators, but actually something which can provide the values for whole societies for long periods of time. And so I think that this is something which is actually a very, very important contribution which Buddhism can have for the future. Okay, also challenged by early Buddhism, abbots. There's no abbots in the Vinaya. Yes, go on. Yeah, yeah. Look, I would agree with that, and I think that it's very reductive to say that Buddhism is just a way of life. I think the defining feature of a religion is that it has some. It's not just a way of life. I think that's only part of it. The point about a religion is that it's a way of life which is orientated towards and guided by a notion of the highest good. And for theistic religions, then the highest good, of course, is God. From the Buddhist point of view, that's Nibbana. And I think that's the thing which actually the different, to me, that's what the defining point is, which distinguishes, say, a religion from something like a psychology or just a lifestyle choice or something like that.
But isn't humanism the same thing? Isn't that also guided by the highest good?
I don't think in materialism and humanism you have an idea of the highest good. You only have an idea of a relative good. Yeah. It's like you have an idea of an evolution towards a better good, but not the idea of an ultimate good, a paramattha. Yeah. So okay, theism. Any more questions on theism before we go on? Yeah, go on. Ah, okay, caesarean, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, for sure. Look, and that's you should laugh. I mean, that's the idea that the Buddhists taught about a virgin birth was explicitly used by the Roman philosophers in the debates between Christianity and paganism in the 3rd and 4th centuries, right? And so this was considered as axiomatic and so well known. So it was so well known among the educated classes in the Mediterranean region around that time that you would refer to it in passing in an argument. You know, lots of people believe in virgin births, like the Buddhists and so on, right? So this was kind of something. yeah, this is something which was very well known in those days. And just to be entirely clear on the point, most of the later developed lives of the Buddha, okay, which are the vehicle by which Buddhism is actually conveyed to people, most of those texts explicitly say that Suddhodana and Maya were not together on the night that she conceived. Okay? So of course it hardly needs saying that these ideas are not part of early Buddhism. What you do find in the suttas quite an elaborate version of the Bodhisattva's birth, which already has quite a lot of miracles and so on. But that particular text, which is a passage found in two places, has many, many signs of being a later addition to the canon. So we're finding that birth story is already being elaborated, you know, right from the early period. Yeah. In fact, the most interestingly enough, out of that whole legend, okay, there's one place elsewhere in the canon where it talks about the Buddha's birth, and it only mentions one fact, and it says that the Buddha's mother passed away 7 days after he was born. And that, you know, that's mentioned in one other sutta as kind of an isolated fact. And of course, that's very realistic. It was very common for mothers to die in childbirth or shortly afterwards. And we know that the Buddha was brought up by his stepmother. So actually that particular detail seems like it's very realistic. Kuan Yin, yeah. Oh, you read my book called White Bones, Red Rot, Black Snakes, yeah, which is awesome. And talks about that at extensive length. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Acharya Buddha Sutta. Yeah. When the Buddha, after being born, took 7 mighty strides to the north and roared with the voice of a bull, "I am the greatest in the world." Yeah, I tend to think that might have been a later edition, but you know, there might be room for. Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it needs to be reimagined, that. Well, it's physically possible, yeah, it's extremely unlikely. Yeah, it's extremely unlikely. As far as I understand, medically, it was basically an extremely fraught operation until recent times. Yeah, but then she did die. So, yeah. Look, but the whole thing about the side and stuff like that. Actually, see when a lot of the times, one of the interesting and recognized principles of mythology, and there's a word for it which escapes me at the moment, is where myths are invented by back readings from iconography. Okay? So things are represented in pictures or sculptures in a certain way, and that might be for a certain reason, but then later on people forgot what that reason was and then invent stories to explain that. Now, in this particular case, you know, you often see represented in the birth becomes represented by an elephant, a white elephant, with 6 tusks entering Maya's side and so on. And you can see from those depictions, which are quite early, around 2nd century BC, that, you know, that's just a physical way of representing, you know, of making a visual image that you can do to represent the conception, right? And so from there, then the whole thing, the birth from the side and things, I think came from the imagery rather than the other way around. So yeah, I wouldn't bother about trying to explain it as a cesarean, personally. Sorry? Oh, okay. Okay, interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah, sorry. Apocryphal? No, there's apocryphal is a more general term for sort of more or less arbitrary or non-canonical legends that accrue, but there's a specific term for legends which are derived from iconography as an explanation for an iconography. Yeah, I can't think of that for the moment. Yeah. Yes. Look, I haven't done a whole lot of research in that area. I think most of the deities are probably local and internal developments in Buddhism, but there's probably some relationship. Some of those things are discussed by Etienne Lamotte, a Belgian scholar, in one of the later chapters. He wrote a book called Indian Buddhism, which they'll have in the library here, and that he collects a whole range of evidence which looks at the relationship between Mithras, Maitreya and Jesus, especially in the Silk Road and Central Asian regions. And that was around, I think, 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, something like that, yeah. So I think there was some influence, but most of the... There are other suggestions. For example, you have in the Tibetan Tantric pantheon, you have Heruka, and so sometimes suggested that that's Hercules. He actually has a lot of iconography of Hercules as well. So. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. May well be so. There may be something to that, yeah. Yeah. Okay, moving on. So from theism to abbots, Buddhism. So from God, we're now stepping up to abbots, and so having been in that, when I first went to Santi Monastery, I tried to say don't call me an abbot. There's no abbots in the Vinaya, and after all, everyone just calls you abbot anyway, so you just sort of give up. But yeah, there is no. It's very interesting to think there's no abbot in the Vinaya, right? There's no power, like an individual monk has no power of command over other monks in the Vinaya. Okay, there's no requirement to obey people who are senior to you in the Vinaya, right? None of these things exist. The power of command that exists in the Vinaya is only the power of command of the Sangha, right? So the Sangha as a whole can make a decision, and other monks have to obey that. But if the Sangha gets together and makes a decision regarding Ajahn Brahm, so we're telling Ajahn Brahm X, Y, Z, as long as it's in accord with the Vinaya, right, then Ajahn Brahm has to do what we say. So, and that happens, doesn't it? I mean, the Sangha gets together sometimes and makes decisions that Ajahn Brahm doesn't like, and he has to just accept it. So this is something which I think is really important and a very vital part of early Buddhism, which is, and it's actually very challenging. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why, you know, certainly my experience has been that most abbots, apart from Ajahn Brahm, don't really encourage this kind of inquiry. It is quite, you know, it's a bit like the Australian Constitution. There's no mention of the Prime Minister in the Australian Constitution, right? So it's a bit like what's actually... what's actually going on here? So the whole notion of the patriarchy and power being dealt by a patriarchy, the Buddhist Sangha is organized in a way that's very flat, very democratic, consensus-based, and so on. And I think that social and cultural model actually provides an excellent and, again, very challenging and inspiring example for us to live by today. Yes. Sure, and you have this sort of concept in the Vinaya and the Dhamma, like the Sangha Nayaka and the Sangha Thera, like the elders in the Sangha and the leaders of the Sangha. So for sure, and in that consensus basis, they have that. But that then doesn't, according to Vinaya, empower that person to then have that power of command over the others. So and even in the secular sphere. Like a king was supposed to rule with very much with the consent of the people, you know, like the first king in the Aganya Sutta is like the Mahasamata, the great elect. So, you know, definitely there's a role for that Sangha leadership, but it's just that it's not a sort of absolute top-down despotic leadership, that's all. I mean, just to contrast that with, say, the Sangha structure in Thailand, where the king appoints the Sangha Raja. And then from there, then either the king or the Sangha Raja appoints then the Sangha Council, and the Sangha Council then appoints all the different functionaries and so on and so forth in the Sangha. So it all comes from the top, ultimately from the king, and then to the Sangha Raja, and then down through that. There is some kind of bottom-up processes in the Thai system as well at a local level. So, for example, if you choose an abbot for the monastery, according to the Thai system, you should get together with the Sangha, the local villagers, and a representative from the Sangha hierarchy, sort of the local head of the sort of official Sangha officialdom. And then those three groups have to be represented at a meeting, and at that meeting then the abbot should be chosen with the consent of all of those three groups. So there is some acknowledgement of that kind of grassroots decision-making and so on at a local level, but in terms of the national level, it's completely top-down. Yeah. So, yep. Well, does it matter whether it's labelled? Yeah, sure it does. I mean, tax for a start, visas. There's all kinds of practical purposes where things have to fit inside boxes. You know, I mean, maybe it doesn't matter ultimately, but you know, that's how society works. So I think it's important to be clear about these things. Other religions that don't believe in God. The other case which is often cited is Confucianism. Which is also in some ways very difficult to classify as a religion or not a religion. Hinduism is also an interesting case because basically Hinduism is kind of a word that you use to describe what Indians think, and Indians think all different kinds of things. So that there are theistic, polytheistic, atheistic, monotheistic, and just about any other kind of brand of Hinduism that you could possibly imagine. So again, that's another classificatory issue, isn't it? Whether a religion where it's so hard to pin down any kind of defined belief structure is also an interesting concept. But yeah, anyway. Yeah, go on. Right. Yeah, so call yourself a Buddhist. Be proud. Out and proud.
Yeah, but I think it's also... Okay.
Mm.
Very good.
Very good.
I think there's many, there's a number of issues here. I think that's one issue, and that's kind of a political issue. And of course it matters as well, because you want to have some kind of input on the political system. You're going to have certain numbers, that certain matters. But I think another thing is just that the word religion, generally speaking, has a very bad name, you know, in the modern world. And if you say that you're religious, people say, sorry, well, okay, you are kind of a slightly nutcase being religious. So that is part of the problem. It's almost like a marketing issue. Are you a religion or not? And I think that you can say that from many points of view. You can argue that Buddhism is not a religion, just as you can argue it is a religion. Depends on how you define this thing. Basically, how do the vast majority of people view a religion? Probably that there is a creator God, right? There's some kind of supernatural power outside of the kind of non-universe, who kind of influences events in the universe. At the very least, the creator of the universe. Well, Buddhism isn't like that. So from that point of view, it's not a religion. I recently read a book called The God Argument by A.C. Grayling, who's one of the most prominent philosophers in the UK. And he was arguing just that point. He was saying that for him, a religion is the idea when you have some kind of supernatural power outside of, you know, ordinary phenomena. And from that point of view, he said Confucianism and original Theravada Buddhism are not religions, because they don't have this idea of something outside of nature working on nature. I think it matters. The other thing about religion is that if you look at the etymology of the word, apparently, religion is derived, it's a Greek word, and it derives from bond. You're binding yourself to something, right? You're holding on to something. And whether Buddhism actually fits quite into that category is also an interesting question. Buddhism is more kind of a looser connection to religion than traditional religions, perhaps.
Did we have some other hands at the back earlier? Jake, did we have an unanswered question from you? Jake, can I just interrupt there to clarify the point? Yeah, that's quite true. And you know, you'd find like people, Putra Moggallana would be referred to as one of the words they use is Sangha Nayaka, which literally means leader of the Sangha. As a literal translation of Nayaka is one who leads. So there is that. I mean, just the interesting point though is that in terms of the actual mechanisms of the Vinaya, that the Vinaya makes allowances for Sangha members to be appointed to have, in a sense, jurisdiction over limited spheres of activity. So, for example, you can be appointed to be the stores master or the guest master and you look after that sphere of activity. But there actually isn't a mechanism in Vinaya to appoint a particular monastic to have a general jurisdiction over the Sangha as a whole, which I think is kind of interesting. Yeah.
I think
Eddie, a brief question. Okay, good. Okay. Thank you for that comment, Eddie. That's very, very useful. Thank you. Okay, last point. Discrimination. Sexism, all this kind of stuff, which you find is one of the major forms of suffering in our world, and in particular nationalism, and this has been this is a very, very major feature of Buddhism, most forms of traditional Buddhism. Highly nationalistic, and in some cases that kind of nationalism can be merely a kind of, you know, fairly benign patriotism and pride in your culture and so on and so forth, but of course that becomes very problematic when times get difficult, and especially we've seen in recent years and indeed in recent months with the eruption of violence between Buddhists and Muslims in multiple countries in the in our region, Bangladesh, Burma, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and India. In fact, it's easier to list the countries that haven't had violence between Buddhists and Muslims in our region in the last couple of months. So nationalism isn't the only force at play here, but it certainly is one major force. I think that early Buddhism provides an excellent model for an international religion. I mean, the Buddha was constantly walking across national boundaries. He was walking from Rajagaha to Savatthi and then to Vajji and back and forth across all these different places. That's what his life was spent doing. And he never made any difference or any distinction in those kinds of, in his teachings or his allegiance or anything like that. And that, I think, is really, really important for Buddhists. And I think this is one of the main reasons why, as I mentioned earlier, I think that there's been a sad failure on the part of the traditional Buddhist cult countries in the last few decades to build on the early work which was done in the earlier part of the 20th century and to make Buddhism into a really global religion. And I think that we haven't capitalized on that, and I think one of the main reasons why is because of simple nationalism. And this plays out in different ways, of course, in different cultures. The one country I'm most familiar with is in Thailand. I lived there for 6 years, and I know in Thailand, of course, they basically replaced the triple gem is the king, religion, and the country, and that all the sort of children pledge their allegiance to in the morning. And there's an extremely strong identification. You know, you're programming children from before they even know what these things mean, really. You're programming these ideas into their brains, right? And so it just becomes such a fundamental part of how you view the world. So this is something which I think needs to be considered and reflected on very, very carefully in all the Buddhist cultures, and to see how we can free the Dhamma from this kind of nationalism. And so that's the only way it will ever become really relevant as a global path and as a global teaching. Sexism, of course, another major problem. We find the Buddhist institutions, especially the Sangha in the Theravadan and Tibetan countries, is one of the most sexist institutions in the world. It's one of the very few major institutions left in the world where women are not merely marginalised, but completely excluded from things like ownership of property. In Thailand, you have all of these arguments about vinaya procedures and all of this kind of stuff, but when it basically comes down to it, there are billions and billions and billions of dollars in real estate in Buddhist monasteries in Thailand, and anybody who thinks that the actual issue is about a vinaya procedure doesn't really know much about human nature. So this kind of institutionalized sexism, which denies women a voice, denies women an opportunity, denies women education, and denies them a place for doing anything else in the sasana other than cooking food and giving it to monks, is very strongly challenged by early Buddhism. And we find within the early Buddhist texts, with things like the Terigata and other places, that some of the earliest literature, spiritual literature by women anywhere, and a very, very strong basis for the fundamental insights which have led to the movement towards equality in our modern times, which is simply that a person's worth is not based on their gender or their race or their religion or their caste or whatever else they might have, but it's based on the qualities of heart which a person develops, and those qualities of heart are the same no matter who you are or where you come from. So any kind of discrimination that you can imagine, of course, the classical example and the form of discrimination which was most alive as an issue in the Buddha's day was the caste system. And this was something which was very fundamental and discussed in many places in the Buddhist scriptures as the Buddha's challenge to that caste system. That was the issue at that time. But, of course, we shouldn't be so naive as to think that the issue is only about caste. It obviously refers to or can be extended to any other form of irrational or baseless discrimination, because they all cause suffering. And I think this again is, I think this is one of the most powerful forms of challenge which early Buddhism has regarding traditional Buddhist cultures. Comments, questions? Annie, go on. Oh, well, you know what I've done, so I don't need to tell you, but there's still a long way to go. Yeah. Well, look, I'll just tell you an example, and I'm sure you remember this case when we had our bhikkhuni seminar in Santi Monastery a number of years ago, and we had some nuns visiting from Taiwan, some bhikkhunis visiting from Taiwan, from the Nan Lin Monastery. And we went for Pindabhata, we went for alms round in the local village. And at Santi Monastery, we had followed the practice of alms round, and food was being taken in accordance with seniority. Whether you're a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni and so on was irrelevant. And so that's how we went for alms round. And the nuns from Nan Lin said, we should follow behind the monks. And so the abbess from Nan Lin Monastery was there, and she's senior to me, right? So I said, no, you're senior, you have to walk in front. She said, no, we have to walk behind. I said, no, you have to walk in front. And I said, Well, look, if I was in your cult, if I was in your country, I would respect your culture and I would walk in front if you insisted on it. But you're now in our culture. You should respect our culture in our country. And she said, okay, that's fair enough. She said, but we're going to take a film and we're going to take it and show it back in Taiwan. And if people see us walking in front of the monks, they're going to go, well, these nuns are... So I said, okay, well, we can video a clip of you guys walking behind, and you can show that in Taiwan, but when we do the main Pindavata, you have to walk in front. So where there's a will, there's a way. And as long as, you know, people are willing to talk about it and discuss it, these things are actually quite trivial. They're not really important in themselves, but they become, get made a big thing. I've had, you know, several women comment to me things along the lines of, they never thought about gender before they went to a Buddhist monastery. They never felt like a woman. They just felt like a person. And they've come to a Buddhist monastery and suddenly you're a woman, you have to go over there. And, you know. That's right, yeah. Yeah, so it's actually being created in that context. So, yeah. Again, just to remember that these issues are, of course, being discussed and negotiated all the time in every culture. Again, from my experience with Thailand, you know, my own experience, you know, people have this idea that, Thai monks don't like bhikkhunis and so on and so forth and things like that. My own experience in Thailand, I went and stayed with Western monks who, at least one of them, was extremely down on bhikkhunis and criticizing me and quite aggressively attacking me in public and so on for my support for bhikkhunis. And then I left that monastery feeling not particularly pleasant. And then I went to visit my teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai, in Bangkok, who was so warm and friendly. It was so wonderful to see him. And then we were visited by a Thai seminary who came along to say hello and Ajahn Chachai. And it was the first time that in that monastery that they'd seen a woman in the brown robes. And so when she came in, and the lay people were so lovely, and they invite her in, please come and sit down, and they offer her something to drink and pay respects and all of this stuff. And then we're talking with Ajahn Chachai, and then he said, how come you know Bhante Sujato? And she said, because he's been very helpful for the bhikkhunis and the nuns and so on. And then Ajahn Chachai said, that's because he has a lot of compassion and doesn't discriminate. Oh, that made me feel really nice. Good. So it was, you know, that was my experience. Yeah? And, you know, I've spoken to so many of the nuns who've lived in Thailand and so on as well, who've had also very similar experiences and felt very supported and accepted by the monks' communities. So, you know, we shouldn't ever take a simplistic or naive approach to these things. These things are always quite many-faceted. Okay, so we're now at 2:30. So our session is now up and we've got to the end of the first slide. Okay. Now we're going to have a break for tea and we'll come back after tea. Now what I would like to ask you, normally what we do is we break for discussion groups after the tea and then have a back for a group discussion for half an hour at the end. Would you like to continue with that format for today, or would you like to continue with more of a full group discussion as we've been doing now for the final session? What would you prefer? So I'm hearing that you want to all go into the separate groups, is that right? That's democracy in action. Okay. Okay, so we want to have the full group discussion. Okay, we'll do that. So we'll see you all back here at 3:00. Okay, very good.
Just 8 days ago, you know, like, it's about the latest on the progress of Guru Ordinance. And I just want to share that at the end, there's you and Ajahn Brahms. I didn't see the whole thing. The Buddha's forgotten nuns.
Maybe you can announce that people can come in here, look, or pass it around. So, I mean, many people haven't seen this sort of thing.